Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Donaldson Files here, the Tuesday edition. And we're going to spend this hour, and we got 2 hours that Dr. Larry and I are going to follow up on some themes that are going to begin this hour. So we're going to have 3 hours of great radio and over the next 3 hours. We're going to talk about things from perspective that people don't normally talk about. And joining me to help me along is the Swamp Girl herself, from Columbia, South Carolina. Pam, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Tom. It's pretty hot down here, though.
Well, guess what? It's pretty hot.
Doing
it's pretty
good
hot
today.
Up here. Yeah, it's pretty hot here, too. So, yeah, we actually got what we call very humid. Well, at least we did have humid weather until it started raining.
Yeah, well, it was only 91 degrees here, but the heat index got up to 102.
Yeah.
Because it's just wet out there, you know, it's just, and it's a little bit difficult to do things outside, you know, but people are still walking outside and doing, you kind of learn how to do that here, but it's, when you do about probably a quarter of a mile walk and you get home and you're just wet, you know.
Yeah. And wet doesn't sweaty wet. Yeah, I know what you mean.
All right. It's not sweaty. It's just that much wet in the air. You just...
Yeah. But here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do tonight. There's some things I've been writing about. And I want to get your views on them. I'll put them on DonaldsonTFiles.com. DonaldsonTFiles.com. That's the my blog that I do in association with the show. And plus, sometime this hour, I'm going to read excerpts of my book that is now in the publishing. It was with the publisher. So we're, you know, trying to get it published. So, and you, Pam, will be the first to comment and listen to America at the Abyss. So, but.
Well, I read the last excerpt that you sent out, the last little thing.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's going to be.
Pretty
now,
interesting.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Here's the thing. I've had people say to me privately, you know, and we're going to talk more about this tomorrow as well. I mean, this is what I wrote at DonaldsonTFiles.com, which I did put on the, you know, the timeline for Twitter. And, and basically, here's the way I'm kind of looking at it is this, you know, Biden is the symptom. While many in the Democratic Party are shocked by what has happened in Afghanistan, and we've seen, you know, off-the-record leaks that's, that we in the military and intelligence told Joe this would happen. And there are even a few people in the media complaining. Now, the reality is, you know, the Biden bungling of Afghanistan was a disaster that's been coming for two decades. But Biden's policy turned it into disaster. But his policy turned into disaster, anything but Afghanistan. Now, here's the point I'm going to make to the audience. And this is a point, you know, I made on Twitter. And that is this. Would we have seen anything different with another Democrat, if a President Harris, a President Sanders? Take, for example, economics. Okay. The economic plan of Joe Biden is increased spending, loose monetary policy, increased taxes on the productive side of the productive part of society. And we have to say inflation is like too much money chasing too few goods. But the plan we're seeing now would not produce enough goods to soak up the loose money. In other words, inflation, inflation may not be the transitory thing. We may see a repeat of the 70s. The energy policy are based on the illusion that we can produce all of our energy with wind and solar while eliminating fossil fuels. So that's the goal. But yet we have, you know, Joe Biden begging OPEC to increase production. But again, would anybody else done this any differently? Yeah, you know, the foreign policy has been a disaster, but would any of these other individuals done the foreign, you know, done foreign policy any different than what we'd be seeing? You know, immigration and crime. These are all issues where, quite frankly, you know, would there have been a major change from any other president? In other words, and this is a point I make. Biden's policies would have been a disaster in any leading Democratic presidential candidate. Their policy followed Biden's. Bernie Sanders essentially wrote the $3.5 trillion stimulus. Alexandria Cortez wrote the Biden version of the Green New Deal. And so my question to you is Biden, would there have been anything different from any other Democrat based on some of the, based on what I said? Do you see a President Harrison, a President Sanders doing that much different in what we're seeing right now? Your thoughts?
My thoughts on that is definitely no, but my reasoning may be a little bit different because you're talking about individuals. I believe that the Democratic Party on the whole has been hijacked, and I don't think Biden has full reign, and I don't think Harris would have full reign. And as far as Bernie's concerned, I think that Bernie would have totally ignored Afghanistan. Bring him home. Don't worry about it. You know, see you, bye. I think he would have been a little bit different. But I think it's the handlers in the party right now. I don't think it is Biden himself being president that's making a difference, and I don't think it would be Harris herself that's making a difference, you know. I believe it's the handlers. And the handlers are still stuck on anything but Trump. They're still stuck on it. And as long as they stay stuck on that, you're going to see the same thing with anybody who's president in the Democratic Party right now. I mean, there's people behind the scenes there that are doing stuff. You know, these generals and stuff knew better. You can't tell me these military people didn't know better and didn't, you know. But the ignorance is anything but Trump. You know what I mean?
Exactly what I mean, because if you look at the immigration policy, for example, they reversed everything he did on immigration. I mean, one of the aspects is we saw a decrease in illegal immigrants coming into the country, and we've seen the flood coming in. And so they did that. I know in the Middle East, they went back to the policies of Obama dealing with Iran and trying to restart the Iranian deal, and they pretty much ignored the Abraham Accord, which would have united the Sunni, the Sunni Arabs and the Israelis.
Correct.
And
correct.
So it's it's almost like anybody but Trump.
If Trump even thought of it or even talked about it, they are totally going in the opposite direction. Whereas some of his stuff may have been good, but nobody wants to look at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, but here's the question, but you make an important point. You mean who's controlling the party? And I think that's a legitimate question to ask, because I know that, like Coco, for the past year, has always talked about the influence of the Bernie Sanders, which she called the Bernie Bros. And I think the Bernie Bros have a definite impact on the political definite impact on where the party is going. As I stated in the beginning, that's the reason why I made the statement, would we have seen that much difference? Because like I say, Bernie Sanders essentially is writing the green, wrote a good portion of the stem. I mean, this is like coming out, his ideas. And certainly Alexandria Cortez and came, the environmental policy, the green, the climate gate, change policies and the energy policies are coming pretty much out of Alexandria Cortez. And it's, you know, I guess the, you know, and so my question is going to be, and I want you to think about this as we take a, you know, take a quick break here. You know, who do you think is influencing the party at this point? This is Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files, and the Bachelor News Radio Network.
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri, was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds of him going on to fascinate millions with his talent? 1 in 260,000. The odds of this born racer having 157 career top 10 finishes in NASCAR? 1 in 125 billion. But every driver seeks the pinnacle of their achievements. The odds of him winning both the Daytona 500 and the Brickyard 400 in the same year? 1 in 195 million. The odds of a child being diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm NASCAR driver Jamie McMurray, and my niece has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
Welcome back to the Donaldson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Look, folks, if you want to know more about how to listen to our shows, here's what you need to do. Go to bachelornews.airtime.pro, thebachelornews.airtime.pro. This show is repeated every day at 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Eastern Standard Time. And so, and you can do that every day. You can also get us on StreamYard, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, and Anchor.com. So all of those places you can see all of those. Listen to this show repeatedly. And if you want to learn more about, we have a special price on advertising, an introductory price. Give us a call or email labachelor40@gmail.com, labachelor40@gmail.com. Okay, here's the question I left you with. Who do you think's running the party? Who do you think's in charge? Which wing of the party is in charge?
Which wing of the party?
I
believe when you ask a question like that, as a regular person walking around, follow the money. Whoever's ever given the biggest donations to the party is usually the person that has the most influence on the party. Now, we know that the money maker is Obama. You know, that's what he does. That's what he's always done. That's what he knows how to do. However, when you're talking about policies and things like that, just look. One of the individual donors with the highest number, the highest amount of money, I believe, is a drug company. I don't think I probably need to say that on the radio, but anybody could look it up. You know,
yeah.
If you look and see who is contributing the most to the Democratic Party, then you'll usually know who has the reins of the horse, you know.
Well, I mean, okay, here's the answer. Yeah, actually, interesting enough, because I made this point in my last book, and I'm making it, and certainly it's a point that I'll be making in this, you know, as well. But to answer the question,
but I hate to say it the other way around. Who made most money off of us going into war? And you know, I could run to both sides of the fence sometimes. But back then, you know, everybody had their hands dipped into, and I'm talking about Republican and supposedly, but they had their hands dipped into the war machine. You know, their interest, their investments, things like that. And, you know, you kind of have to shake your head and So these people are going to benefit the most from this chaos right now. You know, who benefits the most from me having to pay so much for gas or me having to pay that? Who's going to benefit the most from that? That's when I might look into an electric car. Boom, look who's contributing to this stuff. How did the Green New Deal come about? No, AOC did not write that thing. I know that. She just hasn't exhibited enough intelligence to write something like that. Bernie? Yeah, maybe.
Well,
I mean, that's just where I'm at with it.
Yeah. Well, here's the
follow
thing.
Follow the money.
Okay, let's follow the money. Because the money comes in different ways. One of the points I made is that basically what you have is a combination of oligarchies, your big tech companies, who are probably your biggest contributors to the Democratic Party. And then you have, you know, everybody's Republicans' favorite boogeyman, George Soros, and the Soros. And certainly Soros over the years have been a bigger contributor. And I would say, you know, what you have is a party funded by some very wealthy people. And you have a party, as I stated in my first book, Democratic, you know, The Rise of Democratic Socialism, is that the Democratic Party, even though is essentially the Socialist Party of America. So, you know, I would say that it's a combination, you're following the money. So the money comes in from, let's say, the oligarch, you know, the tech companies. An example would be what we call in the political business Zuckerberg dollars, bucks. Well, Zuckerberg from Facebook contributed hundreds of millions of dollars on get out the vote type campaigns in, you know, 2020. So, you know, he's a major player at the table. He's a major player at the table. And certainly, you know, he's also a guy that, you know, I mean, and it's kind of my theory is very simple. And I'll throw this out to you. My theory is very simple in that socialism as we identify it is not going to be the socialism we end up seeing. It would be more closer to what I would view as fascism as opposed to socialism in the sense that you're going to have private companies exist. Facebook's job will be, you know, they're the media, you know, they're part of that media side of the equation to make sure that and what they would like, you know, what, and again, they work in concert with their democratic, you know, their democratic politicians, whether it's censorship, you know, censoring certain people from being on, you know, censoring certain ideas from being on.
Mm-hmm.
And Twitter and all of those. I mean, if you go back just to the case of simply trying to, you know, the Joe Biden story or the New York Post, essentially, you know, for about 1 week, they were not even allowed to tweet anything. Story.
Correct.
And if you try to tweet that story, you know, you were blocked from doing it. I mean, I know I tried to pass it around twice for like 40 or 48 hours. Well, here's the thing. It's kind of like, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. Scratching the back is, you know, Facebook is a very powerful entity. They are controlling the social media. They have expanded the social media. And basically, they will love nothing more to have a regulatory atmosphere that keeps future opponents out and allows them more power to stay in. In other words, make sure the regulations hurts the guys behind me, not me. In exchange, they make their deals with the Democratic Party when it comes down to censoring certain ideas. You know, go look at the Parler. An example of this, you know, like, you know, now I use this in the book, you know, Parler. Essentially what happened to Parler is competing with Twitter. And have many, and they were Twitter was losing people to Parler. And Parler is basically becoming the conservative version of Twitter. I don't know if you have a Parler account or not.
I still do. Yeah, I did before all of that happened and it went offline.
Well,
and all
the thing that came in play is like, you know, whether it's Amazon, Facebook, Apple, you know, basically they pretty much prohibited Parler from being, you know, able to get their message out. You know, it's, you know, long and short of it is.
They took them off the internet. I mean, you couldn't get on for much. I mean, you know, I had been on Parler and you know, had followed a few people and stuff because I'm not a big social media person, but yeah, it was interesting how they did that. And then when they came up in a little blurb, you know, it just came up in a little blurb and then they went away again. It was interesting, you know, and they're back up now, I believe, right?
Yeah, they're back up, but it's certainly they don't have the same impact they had before.
Nobody's fixing to get elected right now.
But the point I'm making here is that they did the bidding of the Democratic Party, and they did it in such a way as to keep it legal. You know, it's not like the government is keeping these people from speaking out. It was a private company's keeping people from speaking, which is, I guess, quote unquote, is their right. Now, you know, that's again, you know, we've had that discussion on this show, and we'll continue to have that discussion about the power of the social media. But my point would be, you know, you've asked the question, follow the money. You asked the question, is that what we're witnessing is the rise of major corporations aligning themselves with a leftist government to basically find their place, make their deals, while at the same time, those companies, in particular small businesses as well, are the ones who are going to get the shaft. In other words, we'll make our deal with the government as long as they allow us, and the deal with the government is going to be is we will allow you to stay in existence if you produce what we want you to produce. We want you to produce more green cars, you produce more green cars. If we want you to produce wind turbines and solar panels, we want you to do exactly that. If you're the gun industry, you know, if we are a banker, we don't, you know, we want to put the pressure that you don't loan money out to gun manufacturers in an effort to get them out of business. And so what we're witnessing is what I call feudal fascism. And I'm going to borrow the term from Joe Cocton, who, you know, phrased this, you know, he kind of phrased it very similar, as he said, the coming of the new fascism. That's how he defines it. And again, it's not, you know, when fascism comes to America or National Socialism, it's not going to come, you know, with funny looking guys with goose stepping, with funny looking mustaches. They're going to come with bureaucrats running, you know, bureaucrats and government officials wearing Brooks Brothers suits. Yeah, just look at China. China, to me, is what the future could be. You know, it is National Socialism. You know, they allow private sector companies to exist. But, but they also, on occasion, remind those companies, as they've been doing recently, you know, just remember, we're the boss. And if we choose to put you in your place, we'll put you in your place. Your thoughts?
Well, I believe that we're kind of sort of doing that now with all this masking, unmasking, masking kids, unmasking, vaccinating, unvaccinating. I believe that we have been moving in that direction. I mean, we have mandates on all kinds of stuff that people don't realize right now and haven't thought about because it became mainstream. They're just, to me, is pretty much the problem with being, I really have issue with the media, but that's been going on for a long time, and we've kind of sort of ignored it. We've ignored it, and we've reveled in the fact that we have media companies out there giving us information from all over the world and stuff, and, oh, these people look like they're doing better. Why would people want to run to America anyway right now? Try to think about that. You know, what is it? Oh, because of the media hype. You know, everybody's telling them, hey, the land of the free, you know, that kind of stuff. Turning out to be that way. I believe we're slowly turning into that. You know, Tom, we don't realize it now. I mean, when you, they're calling things, they're not calling, I mean, you know, whereas you and I would say, hey, we're having taxation without representation. When they put taxes on you for how much you make and things like that. But then with this infrastructure bill and stuff. They want to put internet access. Now, there's a key word to that, internet access. That happened here in South Carolina in one county with one particular person, whereas monies were spent for internet access, which means they put the poles up and put the wires up, but you, as a general consumer, still had to pay that high cable bill if you wanted to hook into it. So, yeah, you had access, but you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't free.
Absolutely. It was part of the money. Yeah, hold on to that thought. Hold on. This is Tom Donaldson. This is Tom Donaldson here, the Donaldson Files with the Swamp Girl, Pam. Here, the Donaldson Files and the Bassler News Radio Network.
Go, Caleb!
Come on, hit a homer, Jesse!
Go, guys!
Hey, did you guys know that kids who play sports earn more money when they grow up?
Of course. I knew that.
Hey, did you guys know that kids who read books have a bigger vocabulary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Wow, jinx. Did you guys know that friendly children have more friends?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. I knew that. Did you guys know that winter babies are better at music?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Obvious. Oh, hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
Huh. I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure I knew that. I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Donaldson Files here on the Bassler News Radio Network. Don't forget the Bassler News Radio Show, with your host, L.A. Bassler, is live every Monday and every Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can get it on Block Talk Radio on this network at that time, and it's rebroadcast every day, 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at the BasterNews.airtime.pro. And if you want to, let's say, a show that discusses issue, race, politics, policing, injustice, inequality in religion and sports, well, that's the Baster News Radio Show here on the Baster News Radio Network. And you can listen to that on the BasterNews.airtime.pro. All right, back to, you make a pretty interesting point there, and I wanted to kind of follow up on the point that you just make. It's, follow the money. You make a very interesting, local example. All right, we're going to give you internet access. But in order to get this internet access, you got to pay the cable bill. So that means someplace, somebody lobbied and said, okay, we'd be happy to help you put all of this up. What are you going to do for us?
Correct.
So go ahead and expound on how this works. I mean, how does this work in South Carolina, an example? And then we're going to follow up on that.
Well, here's one of the examples, and this is why I say we've slowly given up some of our freedoms. We had and he's still in office, so I don't even want to mention him because I really have a problem with the dude. In his district, which is Richland County in South Carolina, I will say that much, parts of it, they decided to do internet access for people. And what they did was, that happens to be a pretty good part of horse country, we would say. There's one section out there where, people raise horses, and there's a horse shelter out there. There's a horse rescue place out there, because we actually are not thoroughbred country, but a lot of people from New York bring their horses down here to stable them for the races. I mean, it's a thing. We have race horses down here. We have steeplechases down here still. And what they did was, the trucks came along and they went on private property and started digging the holes and putting the poles up. So when we ran out there and said, what are y'all doing? They said, well, we're giving you cable access. Well, we don't want cable access poles on the property where the horses are, because somebody might let the horses out when they're coming to check the wires or whatever. Or what happens in a storm down here? I mean, we still get hurricanes and stuff. What's going to happen then? Is it going to be a live wire laying and what? I mean, at that time, we didn't know much about cable stuff. And No, they put the pole up. They put the lines up. So nobody tapped in. But where H Pole was gave that company, that private company, access to your property. They could go in that pasture at any time, leave a gate open if they wanted to, upset the horses with the big trucks and everything because they had put the poles up. There was not a thing anybody could do about it. Nothing. And to this day, when you're hooked up to electricity, when you're hooked up to cable, when you're hooked up, you know, wired, something is wired or gas even to your house, that gives the companies access to your home. And people don't realize that, but we gave that up a while back, and that's what I was talking about, you know, pretty much, that we've slowly been giving up some of our freedoms. Like, I bought this house. I paid for it. Yeah, I got to pay taxes on it every year. I should have some say-so, but as long as I'm wired up, you know, people can come on my property and do their service work, you know, whatever. It's crazy.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this, like I said, this is a pretty, like I said, it's a local example, but it's a example nevertheless, where let's say what appears to be free is not really free. And that, you know, as you say, you have all of the money. But this is a point I'm making as well, and it goes back to, you know, a point that I, you're absolutely correct on. But like I say, I mean, to me, the biggest concern that I have, it goes back, is in fact, you know, where we're going from here. I just got finished reading a very interesting book by a woman by name Carl Roth, who talked about, you know, the pandemic, and she basically, you know, detailed how small businesses were pretty much got the shaft, as she noticed. She said, you know, we didn't really have a true lockdown. What we had a lockdown of small businesses in many of these communities.
Correct. Well, that's what I railed so much about, because they funneled everybody to Walmart. Are you kidding me? They funneled everybody to Walmart. It was the only store that was open for miles. It got exempt for some reason because it was Walmart. So, therefore, you had a higher population going into one area because mom-and-pop's grocery stores were closed. You know, that was the craziest thing I ever seen.
It's crazy, but, you know, these are the things that impact the small businesses, because a lot of these small, hundreds of thousands of these businesses went out of business. And if you look in it, it's not just the rural areas, but middle class, you know, or suburban areas, but if you look in the urban centers as well, same thing. You saw the exact same thing where small businesses, many of them minority owned, were considered not essential, but the Walmart was. Walmart was.
You could buy flowers at Walmart, but you couldn't buy flowers at the floral shop down the street that mom and pop's had for 70 years.
Yeah.
You know.
But, yeah. But this goes back, I mean, this is an example of where, you know, we're heading off to in this regard. And I think it's a very interesting with the regard because, you know, and I say this repeatedly throughout the pandemic, you do not want to have a government with the kind of power that will declare certain business essential and certain business non-essential. Business is non-essential. And that's too much power to give any government. Even in a pandemic, it's way too much power. And I think you make a very good point.
Just wait for it because they're fixing to say that all these Ford and Chevy, if they don't come up with the electric cars, just wait for it. Wait to see how the taxes are going to work because they're selling trucks, you know, that are non-electric. They're gas vehicles. Just wait for it. I'm waiting on it.
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to wait for, because it's interesting, because they're already giving tax breaks if you buy an electric car.
Yeah, well, this new infrastructure bill, but you got to charge it somewhere. But this new infrastructure bill that they have puts a tax, and people don't realize it, but it puts a tax on doing so much mileage on a car now, you know, a gas car. I mean, they're actually doing a travel tax thing, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
But,
that's
festive.
Yeah.
That means I can't come see you.
Yeah. Yes, I know. It's horrible.
Okay,
here's the deal. Okay, here's the thing. Okay, this is what Pam was talking about. Infrastructure bill includes a per-mile road tax test that would track drivers' travel.
Yeah.
But here, here's the, this is the article. This was in a thing called The Drive. Automakers are being pressured by the federal government and signaling that, let's say, all half of your cars have to be electric by 2030. In other words, the government's going to tell Detroit, this is what we want you to produce.
Correct.
Okay. But here's the thing. You know, as fuel cars visit the pump, if you have an electric car, for example, guess what? You know, you're not going to get charged the gas tax. So how do you do this? And the answer would be, is you do what you've just suggested. You come up with a tax per mile, which leads me to an interesting aspect is how do you, first of all, determine this?
Oh, see, here's the fun part, because all these new cars have these OnStar things on them that they can turn on and off at will. If law enforcement can turn them on and off at will to track a car, hello.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding you, dude. And my fun thing is okay, let's say we have a 65 Chevy that we put on the road every once in a while because it's a show car, right?
Yeah.
Who's
going
to be tracking that? Who's going to be, how are you, am I going to be required to put a tracker on it so you can know how far we go in this car, which is a V8, which is a big old gas guzzler? You know, you see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
How are you
going to
do
exactly
that?
That's exactly
how are you
going to
do that with the show cars? You know, how are you, what are you going to do? Are you going to mandate, hell, that's a fun word these days, but are you going to mandate that we put this on our cars if we don't have it installed on the cars when we buy them? Number one. Number two, they're not making electric cars to handle South Carolina weather. I don't know about weather up there where it gets 34 degrees below, but you try that sometime and see how well that works with those batteries they put in them suckers.
Well, let me put it back this way. I would tell you this much right now. If you get an electric car in the winter, it loses about 40% or 50% of its power or of its mileage.
Mm-hmm.
It decreases. So the answer to your question would be, yeah, it does have an impact because you don't get the same mileage as you would get in normal weather in the middle of the winter.
No, they made them for California weather, which is 70 degrees. You know.
Every day,
they made them for weather extremes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how it would work in the very hot, but I know in very cold weather, it decreases its power. So, in effect,
here they catch fire often on the interstate. We have more car fires now than I've seen before. And I'm not saying every car out there that's electric catches fire, but there's a higher percentage, I believe, right now. Somebody did the research of the ones that are overheating here just because of the heat.
Mm.
Those are examples. You ask me who's in charge. You see how that ball just kind of drops, and it's kind of like one of those bouncy balls that hits this, and then it hits this, and then it hits this, and then it hits this before it goes down and hits the bottom. You know, it's just crazy. It's absolutely bizarre when you think about it, and everything is connected to everything else. Everything is connected. You know, the media is connected, money. You ask who was in power? Well, you know, it's the money.
Yeah.
The money is in power right now. And always has been, though, Tom.
Yeah. Well, okay, hold on. This is Tom Donaldson here, the Donaldson Files and the Bachelor News Radio Network.
You might know me. I'm 50 Cent. You may follow my tweets, my Facebook friends. Odds are a few in 6 degrees separate us. We're that close. What's crazy is 1 in 6 don't know where their next meal is coming from. These are your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends. Hunger's too close for us to ignore. So visit feedingamerica.org/hunger and find your local food bank to see how you can make a difference. From one close friend to another, let's do this. I'm 50 Cent, and together we are Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Napa know-how.
Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Donaldson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We got Pam, the Swamp Girl from Columbia, South Carolina. And, again, this is, you make a very interesting point. Like I said, we've been following the money. We've been looking at this. But, I mean, here's the thing. It goes back to the point that I made earlier, where the government is basically dictating to Detroit, you know, you're going to manufacture electric cars.
Correct.
Okay, you're going to do this. We want you to do this. So, in effect, they're dictating what they want Detroit to do, not so much what the market wants, and you know, whether or not people actually want, they do want, you know, Detroit to say, you're going to produce this. We want 50% in 10 years. No, or I should say less than 10 years. And you don't go ahead.
Well, the way I look at it, though, is that that is part of a political agenda because they want this done now. It's kind of like Afghanistan. They want this done now rather than let's sit back and let these companies compete. See if they can come up with the best electric car. I'm waiting for my Jetsons vehicle, my flying car. Sorry, yeah. I've been waiting on that since I was a kid. And I do believe that we're getting there. That would be kind of fun. But let's wait and allow, if you allow companies to compete rather than force things down people's throats, and I'm talking about companies, you'll have a better outcome. You know, it's just, that's just common sense. And apparently it's no, this agenda has to be done now. I want to know what the urgency is for everything to be done now. Why does the world have to be your way right now? You know, what is this about? And usually I find it's politics.
Yeah. But like you said, you make it very, let's go back to the point you just made. You make a very, okay. There's a political agenda attached to the, to this. All right. In other words, we want green cars. We want these green cars because we want to, quote, unquote, save the planet. It's an environmental thing. This is our agenda. And we're going to make you produce these cars, you know, whether or not people want the cars or not. But it also means you have to – so, in effect, it's about mirroring the image. It goes back to the point I made, you know, the point we just talked about at the beginning of the show. Who runs the – you know, who's running the Democratic Party? Is it the people with the money? Is it the activists? Or is it a combination of both? Where, let's say, the car dealership says, okay, we'll make your electric car. Allow us to stay in business, and we'll make your electric cars. And the government says, okay, as long as you make electric cars and you do what we ask you to do on production side, that'll be fine. In Germany, you know, private companies were told, You know, while you're making those Volkswagen people's car, throw in a couple of tanks for our objectives. Yeah, but you get the point. Right. I mean, it's a similar strategy in which corporate America is willing to follow the tune that the government has set to stay in business. It's like, as long as you do what we ask, you can make money, stay in business. But this is, but it is a interesting dynamic because it's,
as I stated, it's the new socialism per se. It's a national socialist approach.
Yeah, but see, here's my issue with that. I told you about allowing companies to compete. And the perfect example I have for that is when they wanted everybody to have airbags. You know, when we grew up, we didn't have anything like that. I don't know if it does good or not. I mean, you know, you can find all kind of statistics and all that. Less people were driving when I was younger. But the whole thing was is that so they forced the companies to do these safety features. Guess what? They tried to do it the cheapest way possible to keep people to encourage people to buy the cars. Guess what? Airbags failed. You know, because they were so quick to do production. And I believe it was the Toyota products that were recalled for that. I may be wrong. Mm-hmm. Probably am. Shouldn't have said it.
Yeah.
Airbags blowing up, you know, the cars, and they had this big old recall. It was mostly all GMs, I think, a lot of the GM cars and things like that. But I remember, I mean, that kind of stuff with litigation, now you got, you know, your tort laws, all this other stuff going into play with that. Everybody wants to make some money, you know, and I understand that. But I do believe that if they quit forcing Green New Deal, and calling it that, more people are more lenient about it. Right now, we are told that we have to recycle. My pa was recycling a long time ago. Before it became like, here's a bucket, go put your stuff in the bucket. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. No,
sure. People will do the right thing if you allow them, but there was a force that, oh, yeah, we're going to do this because we got to have a green, and I hate to say it, but they said a green Columbia, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
People were doing that.
I mean, because the other aspect comes into play here is that, you know, again, it goes to, you know, the point that you and I have been making all along. Is, you know, it's not just about, but see, here to me, it's not just about following the money per se, as much as it's about, you know, following the money, but also following the government policies in which deals are made. You know, and there is this aspect that's coming into play where the government is going to start dictating what you can make or not make, you know, what you can do and not do. To stay in business.
Correct.
And in other words, what we're seeing is corporatism. It's not free market. It's corporatism. This is what Mussolini did in the 1920s. In a way, this is what Hitler did. Argentina is another country that did similar things to this. You know, the Juan Perón. And we always knew it's a don't cry for me, Eva Perón. Well, this was their whole economic policy. Was exactly that.
You can break it back down to now the government wants to mandate that.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to do that. I mean, they are doing it. It's not that they're trying to do it, but they are doing it and forcing penalties on people who decide not to mask for whatever reason. You know.
Well, the other thing too, they're pushing companies to do this. And
correct.
Companies to say, you know, be a good sport.
However, I will look on the other side of that as far as vaccines are concerned. When I worked in the hospital system for a long time too, Tom, and we had to take a hepatitis B shot. We had to have the hepatitis B vaccine. It was mandated. All right. We also had to have a TB shot, a TB test yearly every other year. I think it was yearly. You had to have your TB test. Because TB has not gone away. I mean, all this other stuff is there, but there are some diseases out there that are still prevalent that for some reason it's become this, we will force you to take a vaccine and require the vaccine IDs to get into places and things like that. I totally take issue with all that myself personally, but I also take issue with somebody telling me I have to mask up or not. If you're a company and you say mask at the door, to me it's like shirt and shoes. Yeah, they can do that, and I can choose to go in that store or not. But yeah. but don't tell me I got a mask up in my house.
Yeah.
Ain't happening.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I mean, it ain't happening. Exactly. But I mean, here's the thing, because it's like I said, I had this conversation with a friend of mine this morning, and we got into comments, and he kind of put it this way. He said, you know, massive vaccines are becoming like tribal. It's like, and what he asked me, because he said, let me put it this way. About 3 weeks ago, we had on the Dr. Larry show a physician who, by the way, is a Democrat. And he's a Democrat. And he said, look, you know, here's the thing, Tom. I want the kids in the classroom itself. This remote learning is not working. The kids are falling behind. They're falling behind on the test scores. We need them into the classroom. This is where they're going to learn. And then he added, from places like Sweden, from places like Florida and Texas, and looked at, let's say, those communities that had no real mask mandates and were in schools. And they said not only were they learning, but there was no real significant impact of the virus based on this. And so this is a doctor saying, okay, this is what – and his point was, there's the evidence is coming in. Do the masks provide a significant benefit? The answer is no. But yet here we got people insisting on it. Like most recently, the governor of Oregon now is telling people wear your mask outdoors. Why get
that's
the vaccine?
What I'm talking about. That's bizarrely crazy.
Yeah, this is why get the vaccine if you're not going to get your life back? I remember
but
Kevin Roach who's right.
These people that are making this mask mandate, I don't think they've ever seen the inside of an 8-year-old's mask after wearing it all day. That is the nastiest, most biologically hazardous environment that you ever want to look at. Okay?
Yeah.
Those kids don't know to blow their nose and they don't, you know what I mean? I mean,
it's
absolutely horrible. And to me, it's just like, oh, my God. Our governor is under the gun, though, for that, too, right now. Because he had put in a rule for no mask mandates, and now he's coming under the gun for it.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like I said, the difference, and it's the same thing with vaccine. I oppose forcing people to get vaccinated for a virus that kills 2 to 4 per 1,000. But I got vaccinated. I think there's a benefit to get vaccinated. I think it's proven to be a lot safer than what I originally thought it would be months down the road. But I also think that it's one of those things where, people on our side of the equation are becoming more and more anti-vaccine. As opposed to saying, let's make this about choice. It's like this is, even Donald Trump, whose I think accomplishment was getting the vaccine in record time, something that has not been done.
Well, I'm not an anti-vaxxer whatsoever. I got the vaccine. I'll come publicly and say it. Yeah, I did. But I do have an issue with forcing someone to have the vaccine.
Yeah.
Mine was my choice. I was not forced to have it. No company threatened to fire me to have it. It was my choice.
Yeah.
Now, I was in a different situation, whereas I wanted to do anything to get inside a nursing home to see my mom. And if you want me to, nobody ever came out and said you had to have the vaccine, I felt like that would help me get my foot in the door at the time. So
exactly,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to common sense because we've been dealing with pandemics for a long time, and we know what works and what doesn't work. We know in the case of influenza, the number one, number two things you do. Is number one, vaccination does reduce incidence of the flu. It doesn't prevent it. It reduces it. It reduces the impact of the virus. And number two, you got drugs like Tamiflu. So if you have a breakthrough or if you choose not to get vaccinated, you got treatment. And we got the same thing almost now. We got the antibodies that are available through Lilly, among other things. So you have the vaccination and you have the treatment. Yeah, and
on the other side of the equation, though, you've created an environment there are certain members of the population, if they get a sniffle or a sneeze, they're running and getting a COVID test. And then you got the other part of the environment that sniffle and sneeze, and they refuse to call in for work. They refuse to do this. They are not going to a doctor because they're scared they might have it, and they end up getting it, and then they end up in the hospital unvaccinated adults. You see what I'm saying? And that's in a younger age group than you or I could even talk about. But, I've seen that happen recently.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing I would say, because, when you look at the numbers, the overall numbers is still the people, including the unvaccinated, who are getting the sickest are still the people that were getting the sickest at the beginning. That's number one. Number two, I know exactly what you're saying, but it goes down to test. I mean, like I say, to me, if I designed a test, I said, look, if I was sitting there right now and I was playing Dr. Fauci, I would say very clearly, unless you have symptoms, there's no need to test that person, especially in the line of the fact that many of the tests, like the PCR, are not necessarily accurate in showing whether or not you're infectious.
Correct. But see, what they've done is they've created that environment of fear.
Exactly.
And that fear base is making people run and get tested more, which helps your statistics because you have, a population to, you know what I mean? It helps with your statistics if you know how many people don't have it who've tested for it. You know what I mean? It's kind of crazy, but, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem comes in play, but again, like I say, it's not good public health. And it's certainly, if you look at what the CDC would have recommended in January of 2020, a lot of what we're seeing, they wouldn't have recommended at all. So, and this goes back down to the aspect of the quality of the scientific community, because part of science is trust. And if you lose your trust in your scientific institutions, it's going to be difficult to start treating future pandemics. And in fact, we see this now.
My concern with all of that is that I don't know if you remember when we were growing up, we learned about nature and nurture, about how to nurture babies, and nurtured babies like do a little bit better and people that touch. We already took out hugging in school. Now you're telling us that kids can't go to school. They can't social. You got a whole generation of antisocial little kids, and I'm talking about antisocial as far as behavior. They don't know how to express affection.
Yeah.
Because they're not allowed to. And we're creating that.
Yeah.
We are creating that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I tell you what, we are basically running close out of time. Now, tomorrow night, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Larry and I are going to follow up with some of the themes we've had tonight and follow up with some of the discussions. So, stay tuned. It should be a lively discussion because, Dr. Larry and I have had some private discussions. So we might actually disagree with each other. It's a rarity, but the possibility does exist. So you need to just show up for both the Donaldson Files and the Resistance Hour, Tom, and Dr. Larry and Tom on the Resistance Hour tomorrow night. It's going to be a great, lively conversation. This is Tom Donaldson saying good night from the Donaldson Files.
Good night.
Good night.
want to welcome you to you and the live broadcast show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We're glad that everybody is able to tune in and join us for another episode of the broadcast show. And I need to make sure that I introduce the brother that sits to the right of me. He goes by the name of Chief Swag. How you doing today?
What's going on, Brother Virgil? What's going on to the listeners out there? How's everybody doing?
Oh, man, it's a great day. It's a great day for you and the law, because we've got a guest on the show, and he just retired, Keith, from being a police chief in Georgetown, South Carolina. And so we want to introduce Kelvin Waits, who he also goes by the name of Coach Kelvin Waits. So glad you're able to join us, sir.
Hey, I appreciate the invite, and I'm glad to be here.
Hey, we're glad that you've taken the time out to come on and talk to us about your leadership and life coaching practice that you launched in 2019. It's called Weights Lifted Life and Leadership Coaching LLC. And so, you know, Chief, you're a veteran, you're a retired police chief, you're a husband, you're a dad, you're a mentor, you're a coach, you're an author, and you founded this Weights Lifted. So tell us a little bit more about yourself and how did you come about coming up with Weights Lifted.
Okay. All right. So, you know, I was born in Harlem. I don't think I still have the northern accent, but I was born in Harlem, New York. And lived there until I was about 10. Then I moved to Charleston, South Carolina with my family. You know, went to college. And then after college, I went to the military for 4 years, served my country. And in 1997, I started in law enforcement. I've been in law enforcement ever since. You know, I can tell you that when I first started, right out of the military, you know, my attitude and my posture was, you know, lock up the bad guy, arrest the bad guy.
Uh-huh.
And over time, you know, I realized that there was so much more involved in what we're doing, so much more in terms of serving and service to the public. And I can honestly say that I've grown. And so a couple of years ago, I started thinking about, you know, one day I'm going to retire. I'm going to have to retire. And, you know, I need to, you know, I'm a young guy and I still want to serve in different capacities. And I need to come up with a way. I want to start my own business. And I researched being a life and leadership coach. And my plan was to, you know, when I retired, to roll into this and have something to do and keep it going. And so what happened is, you know, I got things up and running. And one day my daughter came to me and she says, Dad, do you have a name for your business? And I said, no. I said, actually, I've been kind of struggling with that. And she says, you know, she did. She says, listen, she said, God told me to tell you. And I listened closely, you know, because she doesn't normally come at me like that. And I said, okay. And she says, listen, your whole career, your whole life, even when you're not working, you're talking to people, you're encouraging them, you're lifting them up. And so God told me to tell you that you need to name your business Weights Lifted Life Coaching Coach. And, you know, Chief Green, I didn't exchange words with her. I said, okay, you know, and so that's how things kind of, that's what it's like. Go ahead. But that's where the title came.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's
well,
what,
hey, man,
it's
good. It's good when our kids are able to get involved with our careers and also put their input on it. So sounds like you got a very intelligent daughter.
She is. She's a lawyer. Graduated from law school about 4 months
ago. Oh, okay. Well, congratulations to her. Yeah. Yeah.
But so, like I said, my intention was just, you know, get this up and running, not do much with it. You know, I said, you know, hey, if I had one or two clients, it'd be great. And so I started, moving around in it, and things just kind of blew up. You know, I was doing a lot of one-on-one coaching, which was great. Can also burn you out because, you know, still had a full-time job, still, you know, law enforcement, still chief. And then all of a sudden, things changed to where, you know, I started this conversation about facilitating conversations about diversity, culture, and our biases. And for the past year and a half, that's what I've been spending the most of my time doing, you know, talking to nonprofit organizations, talking to law enforcement organizations, talking to school districts. Everybody's wanting to have the same conversation as it relates to this topic. So that's pretty much the background and how I got to be involved in running this, starting this coaching practice.
Okay. Okay. Well, and you know, Chief Wade, you know, me and Chief Humphrey, we talked on the podcast show about the importance of having good leaders and good leaderships in policing. And, you know, so it throughout your career, being in the military and being serving in law enforcement, being a police chief, and especially this past year and even this even before this past year, what would you say would be the climate of leadership in your region where you're at in South Carolina?
You know, the climate is, and I can speak, you know, like you said, for the region and for myself specifically, you know, it has been, you know, and I hope you don't mind me saying it just the way it has been, everybody's been catching hell. Really, for the past year. It's been tough, you know. You all, you and Chief Humphrey know, you know, coming to work and, you know, sitting down and trying to be strategic about things and wondering, have you laid, let me ask you this question, Chief. Have you laid in bed at any point during the last year and a half and thought about what are we going to do if everybody gets sick?
And I think both of us can say yes. Keith,
absolutely. Hey, Chief, how you doing, man?
Good, sir.
I think the thing that we have to remember is that, you know, we're always thinking about contingency plans, you know, but I will say this, Chief, and I think I know where you're going with this one. How do you plan for this? I mean, how do you plan for a pandemic? We plan for weapons of mass destruction, active shooter, large crowds, but how do you plan for something you can't see? And then how do you minimize the impact, the adverse impact it could have? So you're right, you do stay up and you think about, you know, that we got the contingency plan for all those other things. We got those worked out. We got a plan. We got a policy for that. But you're absolutely right. That man, there's been a many a night. What happens if you lose a whole ship? What services are you gonna have to change your vision and stuff? So yeah, absolutely. To answer your question, absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And so you know, my point. Go ahead, keep reading.
No, I was just gonna say, you know, guys, we're gonna be coming up in a few minutes on our first break. But I want to remind our listeners that if you're just now tuning in to the broadcast show, you're listening to You and the Law. We've got on guests who just retired as a police chief in Georgetown, South Carolina. Is Chief Waits. He is has an organization that is Waits for Lifting, helping strong leaders. Building strong organizations. So we want to definitely encourage you to stay tuned in to the show. And if you miss any parts of this broadcast show, definitely tune in to blogtalkradio.com/LA Bachelor to listen to any parts of the show. And let me correct myself, that's TheBachelorNews.airtime.pro. That's TheBachelorNews.airtime.pro, and to listen to You and the Law. But guys, we're going to take this break. We come back. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
If you've got a clogged up nose, simply stuffy. If you've got a snuffly nose, simply stuffy. If the rest of you feel fine, but your nose is out of line, give your schnauzer what it needs, Simply Stuffy.
Simply Stuffy, from the makers of Children's Tylenol. It has only the medicine your child needs to make a stuffy nose simply disappear.
If you want to smell a rose, get the stuff out of your nose. If you're sick or feeling smarty, Simply Stuffy.
Simply Stuffy. Use as directed.
Now you can increase your yields by using Conklin's Guardian slow-release nitrogen additive. Guardian holds your nitrogen in the root zone where it's needed over a longer period of time. That in return can reduce your nitrogen rates. That saves you money. And whether you want it in a dry or liquid formula, Guardian helps in reducing groundwater contamination too. So save your money and be a good steward all at the same time by using Conklin's Guardian.
Welcome back to the You and the Law broadcast on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Again, you can listen live right now at the website. It's on a delay, but you'll listen to it in its entirety at thebachelornews.airtime.pro, thebachelornews.airtime.pro, or you can dial in by phone at 646-929-0130 as they're talking about yet another great topic. Mentors, and I think for your guests, Chief, if I may ask Chief Waits, and if that's okay with you too, Chief Humphrey, in terms of you know, when you look at the landscape, Chief Waits, of some of the new young brothers and sisters coming in as recruits and everything, how important is it to be the mentor? You guys got a gazillion years of experience. So how important is it for them coming in, those new fresh recruits, especially in this climate of hate and division?
Chief Waits, I'll let you take off with that, sir.
Talking about leadership in general, it's extremely important because, you know, we set the tone, right? We set the tone from the time, you know, someone fills out the application as they go through the process, as they go to the academy, as they go to the FTO program. You know, we're all involved in that process, and we set the tone. And I'll never forget, there's a gentleman named Lieutenant Matthew Grayson. You know, when I first started, he was my FTO. And he said, and I never forget, he said to me, he said, "Look, man, do the right thing. Always do the right thing." He said, "But I'm gonna go a little step further." He said, and I'm not trying to be religious or you know, overly religious, but he said, "Trust in God, man. Trust in God and do the right thing, and your career mm-hmm. will be long, and everything will be all right." And so, you know, I think it's important for, you know, I've worked at agencies or interacted with law enforcement officers who said, "Hey, you know what? I don't even know my command staff. You know, my sergeant doesn't talk to me. I walk past these folks in the hallway, and they don't even speak." You know what I mean? And so we have to be involved in these officers' career. And of course, we can't be every place all the time and put our hands on everybody all the time, but we have to be involved. We have to set the tone. You know, we have to let them know that at the end of the day, yes, we all have to go out and do a job, but we all have families. We have to become back safe. We want to make sure that mental health is where it needs to be, and that we, you know, we care about not just getting the incident reports done or doing those patrol watches or doing everything that we got to do as law enforcement, but we care about you as a family. And I think that's a message that we, you know, we as leaders really need to push across and express to our employees.
Exactly. Chief Humphrey.
Yeah, I think it starts from day one. I think what we try to do when it comes to leadership, we forget about the importance of when those recruits first get in the academy. They're leaders. Everybody has that potential, whether you're formal or informal. And we try to handle these kids with kid gloves, and we don't want to talk about that because they may not understand it. And we need to push that to the older guys. We need to push that to – no, everybody in your organization needs to be involved in those conversations about leadership. We have set a tone in our profession that you're only a leader when you've got rank. I'm a firm believer, Chief Waits, and what I know about you and what I've read is that I think I'm safe to say this, and I know Virgil does, leadership lives on every level of the organization. And we have to push that out there. We have to push it, and explain it to where people can understand it. You know, we don't need to use these big terms. You know, people use these vicarious liability. A lot of people don't know what that is, you know. But you can use terms to scare people off, but your main focus is to get people to realize what their purpose in this profession is, and that they can, people are watching, and no matter what you do, you always got to do the right thing. And I had a mentor tell me, hey, it's all about doing the right thing even when people aren't looking. And always reach back and grab somebody to pull them behind you, pull them up with you.
Yeah. Well, and you know, guys, you know, there's a quote that I like, and it's be a voice, not an echo. And I think, you know, that is something that embodies in leadership. And Chief Waits,
did I write that? Is that yours?
Yeah. I came up with it.
Yeah, you will put a copyright on something. I didn't know that. You'll put a copyright on something in a minute.
I wrote that. It wasn't taken from anywhere else. So, you know, but Chief Waits, you made a really good point a while ago when you mentioned that how in some of these agencies that some of these officers don't even know. The only time they may meet any their police chief or people in the command staff is when they are going through the academy or when they graduate the academy. After that, they may not see them for months. And also with some of their supervisors. So it's real important that, you know, those who serve in the position as police chief and as command staff, as captains, majors, lieutenants, whatever the rank may be, is that you build a relationship with these officers. And I think some agencies are so big, they forget that. And that hurts those new officers that are coming in to the agency because they just don't really have that guidance and they don't really have those mentors. And unfortunately, they may end up getting someone who has some bad habits.
That's right. Yeah. And it can happen.
Let me say something about that. Chief Waits, I'm sorry, I just want to say something. So we just had our field training officer review. And if you don't think these young officers pay close attention and you don't think that they're very, they're not oblivious. They are paying a close attention, and they will say when you sit there and you talk to them about their FTOs, their field training officers, they're going to be honest with you. You know, we don't understand, I didn't learn anything. All this one told me about was bad mouths in the administration, or I know where to go and eat free. You know, things like that. And so I don't think
that's
we
real.
Understand that's real. We just finished a process a month or so ago and just listening to, you know, we had one that said, hey, this field training officer is amazing, but they got some major personal issues that I can't learn anything because they're always arguing with their spouse. you know, so That's the kind of stuff they don't realize, that people, these kids aren't oblivious to that. These kids are paying close attention to them, and they get their leadership mindset and their work ethic. I mean, not work ethic, but their, you know, the way they're going to work for the remainder of their career. That's where it starts. You know, that's where it starts. So I just wanted to say that real quick.
No, and I mean, you bring up a great point. You know, and I was just going to, you know, throw out there that, you know, a lot of times, you know, we you know, Chief Humphrey, Chief Green, you know, we're like drum majors, right? And we got this big band, and we got different sections of the band. And a lot of times that if we don't pay attention and make sure that everybody is on the same page, we end up, just because we're busy going to this meeting, doing this, going to this training, we end up putting things on autopilot, right? And, and the information, you may say, hey, I want ABC done. By the time it gets down to the lower rank, it's backwards. You know what I'm saying? It's not what you said. Or somebody on the command staff is saying, well, this is what Chief Green wants us to do, right? Which is detrimental to everything in the process anyway. You know what I'm saying? They need to be saying, hey, this is what we got to do. I mean, everybody needs to be on the same page, and it takes work to get your command staff there, to get your supervisor, your sergeant, it takes work to get everybody on the same page. I had somebody on my command staff say during a staff meet one time, they said, well, Chief, you know, this is your sandbox. Whatever you say, then that's what we're going to do. And my question to him was, well, why do I need you? Wasn't trying to be ugly, wasn't trying to be overly critical, but if, you know, you're not going to think, you're not going to make decisions, you're just going to be a puppet, you're not going to sit down at this table and bring your years of experience and how you really feel about a situation, then why do I really need you? Because we're not getting better. You know, I don't know everything. I'm sure, you know, Chief Green and Chief Humphrey, you know, you take the same posture. I don't know everything. And so that's why we have a command staff, we have a team effort. But it's important in setting that tone to making sure that everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, oftentimes, you know, I think a lot of officers, they get the they already know that, hey, if you're a police chief, you've got a lot of things going on. And but when you do take the time and find the time to really engage with these young officers, it really surprises them. And, you know, just like you said, Keith, when you do these evaluations on the TO, when they went through the FTO program, I think in this generation of people that's entering into policing, the old culture of policing hey, you can't see anything negative about your supervisor, I think you've got a younger generation who are a little bit more inclined to speak up and to be more honest instead of just being reserved and saying, that's not my place, I'm not going to say anything. I don't know, Keith, have you noticed that doing some of your FTO evaluations?
Yeah, if you can get to them before the union gets to them, yeah, absolutely. but I will tell you, they're being very honest. It's a generation that they won't pull any punches. You don't want to know, don't ask them. This is not when we got into law enforcement where you didn't say much. They're going to let you know.
Exactly. Well, hey, guys, we're getting ready to come up on our second break, but we've got a lot of people that are tuned in, listening to the show, and want to thank everybody for being on the line or listening on live to the show. But we're going to take this break, guys, and we come back. We're going to get into the conversation with Chief Waits about Waits Lifted Life and Leadership Coaching, LLC. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
You must be your fairy godmother.
In the classic fairy tale, Cinderella's dream comes true because the glass slipper fits.
It fits.
In our world, the right fit can be just as important.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in there.
Especially when it comes to car seats. Always choose a car seat that's the right fit for your child's age and size.
Oh, that does make a difference.
To make sure your little pumpkin gets there safely every time.
Happy to you. Thank you.
Remember, you're responsible for protecting your children. Their happily ever afters are in your hands. For even more information about choosing the right car seat, visit safercar.gov/the right seat. This message has been brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the You and the Law broadcast on the Bachelor News Radio Network, WTON, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, IBM TV, Big Mind Entertainment. And, of course, you can listen to the show right now at thebachelornews.airtime.pro, or you can dial in and listen by phone at 646-929-0130, the number to get in touch with Chief Keith Humphrey, Chief Virgil Green, and Chief Kelvin Waits, the guest. Just as a reminder, I will be screening your calls. If you have a question or comment for the Chiefs, you can let me know. If not, you can say you're just listening. If you have a comment, either way, I'll be screening. You'll hear silence on the line, and I'll ask you if you have a question or comment. You can let me know either way, and we'll be happy to get those things on the air. Now back to Chief Virgil Green, Chief Keith Humphrey, and their guest, Chief Kelvin Waits.
Hey, guys. We're talking with Chief Kelvin Waits, who is the founder of Waits Lifted and Life Leadership Coaching, LLC. He just retired as police chief in Georgetown, South Carolina. So, Chief Waits, we're glad that you're able to come on the show and talk to us about your life and leadership coaching, and just how that incorporates into what's going on in policing, as well as just in the private sector as well.
Okay, great. Yeah, and again, I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. And you know, both you and Chief Humphrey have been awesome. You can tell that y'all professionals, and I've been doing this for a minute, so I feel real comfortable.
Well, hey, we try to now, you know, Chief, I'm gonna say this.
Watch it when it comes to being a professional.
But as you can see, we like to have a good time on our podcast show, and you know, even with our guests, want to make sure our guests feel welcome and that they'll come back and join us, you know, anytime. So so this won't be your last time coming on the show, believe that.
Gotcha. But just to talk about Waits Lifted a little bit, you know, the name of the company is what it means. You know, my goal has always been just to lift people up, you know, help leaders become better leaders. You know, I do, you know, several different types of training. I do a master class called Never Have a Bad Day. I facilitate conversations about culture, our biases, and diversity. I do a class called Leading in the Dark, Team Forward. I've actually, you know, done presentations and classes for the South Carolina Sheriff's Association, as well as the South Carolina Police Chiefs Association, different nonprofit organizations. And like I said, it goes back to Waits Lifted. I can tell you, you know, I wrote a book about a year ago, a co-authored a book two other gentlemen called Never Have a Bad Day. And, you know, that book came from an experience that I had in law enforcement several years ago. I wasn't the chief at the time. I was a captain. And one Sunday afternoon, I get a phone call from one of my officers and, hey, I hate to bother you. And, of course, you know, what do we say when they call us? And they say that, of course, you're not bothering me.
Yeah.
You can never bother
me.
You know, what's going on? And so the officer said, I'm hooked on drugs. That's what the officer said. I'm just doing drugs. And so the dead.
He said he hooked. Wow.
Hooked on drugs.
Wow. So he said he was dead, he was hooked on drugs.
Hooked on drugs. So the dead silence that you heard right after I said that was the dead silence that was on the phone when it happened. And, of course, you know, you don't expect to get that phone call Sunday afternoon. And so, you know, I kind of gathered myself and I said, well, okay, what's going on? You know, what kind of drug, you know? And come to find out it was pain pills. Officer had been involved in the accident, had back issues, and couldn't stop taking the pain pills. Couldn't stop taking the pain pills. And we, you know, there's a lot that goes, a lot of dynamics that go on within this thing we call law enforcement, right, and service. But sometimes, you know, we deal with people that's walking around and they hurt, and they are hurting. And so it was up to us as leaders and command staff people and all of that to try to do the best we can to look out for warning signs and pick up on different things. But the reality is that sometimes we miss it. So I'm hooked on drugs. You know, we had a strong employee assistance program. You know, I've got that officer hooked up with appropriate people, got treatment. Everything worked out fine. The officer bounced back like never before. And so about 3 months later, after that phone call, I get another phone call from the same officer. And so, Chief Green, what do you think when I saw that number on my phone, what do you think that came to my mind?
It wasn't going to be a good phone call.
I'm going to just tell you, when I saw that, I said to myself, oh, hell, is what I said. I said, oh, hell, you know. And so, hello, hey, just wanted to reach out to you and said, I want to thank you for what you did for me. And I said, no, well, you know, I didn't, you know, anyway, I'm glad everything's worked out for you. I'm glad you're doing better. I'm glad you bounced back. But I didn't really do anything. You know, I just kind of did my job. And that officer told me, they said, Nah, you did more than your job, because you don't understand that when I called you, I was prepared to take my life. I was prepared to take my life. If you didn't answer the phone, I was going to take my life. If you didn't give me the answers that I needed when I got in contact with you, I was going to take my life, right? And so the kicker was, the officer said, the only reason I even decided to call you was because you're approachable. And you never seem like you're having a bad day. That is what that officer said to me. And I'm telling you, that experience changed me as a leader because, yeah, I was approachable, but I was so focused on results. You know what I'm saying? I was results driven. I really didn't, at that time, really dig in deep to really find out who these officers were and you know everything about their families and everything that I really should have known. But when that officer told me that, hey, I was prepared to take my life, but the only reason I decided to call you was because you were approachable and you never seemed like you're having a bad day, that changed me. I was never the same after that, you know, in a good way. And so that was the basis of, you know, the book I wrote and co-authored with these other two gentlemen, because I believe that as leaders, you know, we can't, there's so much at stake. Right, we can't afford to have a bad day. Sometimes people look at me like I'm crazy when I say that because we're human, right? Technically, we all do have bad days, whether it be we woke up with a headache, you know, or our significant others getting on our nerves, our kids ain't acting right, our neighbor's dog barked all night. We are human and we have bad days. But when it comes to leading our people, you know what I'm saying? It's a calling just like being a priest, it's a calling like being a doctor. It is a calling, and when it comes to leading our people, you know, we got a little extra. You know what I'm saying? We got a stronger back to be able to carry the junk that we got to deal with, but still lead these folks at the same time.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Chief, one of the things I think a lot of people, and Keith, you probably have the same, you know, thought. It, being a police chief is, it's just like being a coach of a Division I, whether it be football or basketball. You know, you got all these players that you're dealing with and all these different backgrounds and different attitudes. And how do you manage that? How does your we call them supervisors, but how does your other coaches deal with, how do you deal with them to make sure that they are connecting with these officers? And you know, oftentimes, you know, we kind of get lost with there's so much stuff going on. And when you said that this officer said that you were approachable, one of the things I've tried to do with the agencies that I've served in is just let officers know, yeah, there's a title with the name, but I'm also a person. And guys, you know, I like to cook. You know, I like to get on the grill. So I've invited officers to come over to the house and let's on a weekend. And if I'm grilling, hey, you guys are welcome to come over. And you'd be surprised at the reaction that some of these officers have, because it's like, well, I'm not going to go over to the chief's house. But why not? I mean, but then when they do, they see that you are just as laid back, and that builds that rapport relationship. And that's why that officer called you that day and said, hey, I've got a problem, and you really reached out and helped him.
Look, Virgil,
I
got two things. Go ahead, Chief.
Go ahead, Keith.
No, I was just going to say there is a threat to that whole process as well. And you know, in every organization, you know, we talked about the younger folks, we talked about the millennials. There is what I call, sometimes we got old salty dogs, right? They just old school. That's just the way it is. That's the way it's going to be. Don't be asking me no questions. Go paint the wall green. Get it done, right? And back in the day, that's how it was, but times have changed. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, if we do our part and we make, you know, the officers understand and realize that we're approachable, that, hey, we got an open door policy. Yes, they're structured, and you need to push things up your chain of command. But if you need me, I'm here. A lot of times, behind the scenes, they get discouraged. So don't you be going, let me see you talking to the chief. Don't you be going to talk, you know. And so we got to kind of deal with that and make sure that, you know, our command staff and subordinates, we are all on the same page. That, hey, yes, there's a structure in place. I expect you to use that structure. But if you need me, I'm here. And that's all. I just want to add that to you.
Yeah. Go ahead, Keith.
No, I was going to say, you know, what I tell my guys, my command staff gets upset with me because I don't go to lunch with them. We talk during the day, and I go to lunch with my line officers, with my civilian employees. They need to see that side. And so those are the individuals out there that are on that front line, your first line supervisor, your officers, they need to see a side of you because they don't see it. You know, there's an omen, so to speak, on the administrative wing. Don't go there, because if you go there, that's a bad sign. You don't want anybody to see you going out of there. They don't care about you. You have to reach down and show that you do care. And then on the light side of that, Virgil, did you wash your hands before you grilled?
Always. See there, you know, Chief Waits. Hey, you see the abuse that I have to take. Now I'll say this. Now, I've invited Chief Humphrey over for a barbecue. And now he invited us over, you know, for steaks one time. You know. But so that lets you know his grilling skills is not very well. So but and you know, you're right, and just like Keith said, you know, you really have, you know, when you pull up and you have lunch with some of the patrol officers, they just kind of look at you like, oh, man, is this really happening? Because my own supervisor doesn't do this. But, hey, guys, we're going to take this break, and we come back. We're going to get back into the conversation with Chief Waits, who is the founder of Waits Lifted Life and Leadership Coaching, LLC. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
I never get the flu.
My kids don't need more shots.
I don't have time.
We're all healthy.
My asthma's under control.
I'm pregnant.
I've had the flu. It's not a big deal.
My kids are too old for flu.
The media is exaggerating.
I can fight it naturally.
No matter how you build your excuses, the flu can blow your house down. keep your foundation strong. Vaccinate. Learn more at flu.gov.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
You might know me, I'm 50 Cent. You may follow my tweets, my Facebook friends. Odds are a few in the 6 degrees separate us. We're that close. What's crazy is 1 in 6 don't know where their next meal is coming from. These are your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends. Hunger's too close for us to ignore. So visit feedingamerica.org/hunger and find your local food bank to see how you can make a difference. From one close friend to another, let's do this. I'm 50 Cent, and together we are Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
On the Bachelor News Radio Network, WCON, Big Mind Entertainment, IBM-TV, and of course anywhere else you can download these type of programs, you certainly can do that and listen live and rebroadcast at thebachelornews.airtime.pro. As I go back to you, Chief Green, Humphrey, and Waits, I had two questions come in. Mark said, are there a lot of mentor programs and organizations working to build some of the younger officers coming in? And the other question was, and I of course lost it on my sheet here. Well, you can answer that one first, and I'll pull that up, Chief Green and Humphrey. You guys can answer that first one there.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll say there are quite a few organizations that have mentoring programs, and Keith, you know this just as well as I do, is that NOBLE, which is the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, has a really good mentorship program that's been around for quite some time. So that's one organization that has a really good mentoring program.
You know what? You know what, Virgil? I'm glad you brought that up. And there's about 65% placement for police chiefs coming out of that program, and it could be higher.
Yeah,
I know it's very successful. You know, the other mentoring. You know, I think there needs to be internal mentoring. And then it comes down to the question, Chief, I want to ask you a question. When you go out and you teach these, facilitate these classes, do you find that most of the time people will raise their hand and say, when you ask who's a mentor, are you mentoring someone, or are you mentoring, period? And sometimes, or most of the time, they can only give you one or two names that they're mentoring. They're not talking about a program. They're talking about one specific person because they see something in this one particular person. They don't see it in multiple persons. It appears that I can go with this one person because it's easy. I won't have all the overhead. I won't have all the frustration. But they don't realize there's other people that want to be mentored also. I mean, is that what you see?
Yes, sir, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to say that, you know, in the past I've been successful within the department assigning mentors to new officers that come in. You know what I'm saying? Somebody to check in with them from time to time, make sure they're good, make sure the family's good, make sure they need it. Outside of their FTO or their immediate supervisor, like I said, I've been successful in assigning mentors to people because, you know, in terms of leadership, we have to be intentional about, you know, we can't just put the success of somebody on autopilot and assume that everything's going to go as planned or everybody's going to catch on or everybody's going to make it through the FTO program the very first time because we all know it doesn't happen that way. So we have to be intentional. And like I said, in the past, we've assigned as a staff mentors within the department for different officers, kind of scattered about. And it works.
Okay. Well, hey, LA has got the second question. Go ahead with that question.
Yeah, sorry about that. Linda in Texas asked, it's funny, she had asked about Noble. For those who don't know Noble, the national organization, Black Law Enforcement, is their mission to advance Black in law enforcement into administrative areas or build team leadership and mentorship? And then she said, is there a chapter in every state, guys?
Well,
Virgil, can I answer that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've been answering that one if you don't mind. So thanks, Linda, for that question. Yes to all of the above. No, there's not a chapter in every city. You have to go back.
Or every state.
Every state. I'm so sorry. You have to go back to the reason that Noble, the Black Police Association, Black Law Enforcement Officers Association, why they were founded, because there was no voice. There was no foundation. There was no voice at the table for those people of color who wanted to be in law enforcement executive positions, or that should have been in law enforcement executive positions. I think a lot of times we get confused when we say National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. And for a long time, there was a perception that Noble was just for executives, lieutenants and above.
Yeah.
But Noble is open to all levels of police officers. And one of the things that I've noticed is there's a perception out there that Noble is strictly for African-Americans. But when you go to a conference, you see a very diverse group of attendees. But the focus is Noble has a big seat at the table when it comes to the federal government, when it comes to DOJ. Noble was a big part of the 21st Century Policing Initiative that President Obama facilitated. Noble is well respected in all circles of law enforcement. They are also utilized to facilitate police chief search. When a city is looking for a search, Noble has an amazing reputation when it comes to police departments looking for minority police candidates and police chiefs. So I wouldn't be where I'm at today if it hadn't been for organizations like Noble and the founders of Noble and the founders of NBPA and Black Law Enforcement that set that tone and established that foundation to help make the playing field level. I will tell you this, and my first mentor, I'll just say this, my first formal mentor was a white male sergeant who saw something in me when you would have thought that the Black executives at that time would have been the ones that would have tried to mentor me, but a white male sergeant who had a reputation of being a racist, and he was not. He was just a very quiet person, but he was the one that took me under his wings and mentored me and said, hey, this is the things you need to do to be a police chief. These are the things you need to do when you're supervising people, when you're out here in the community. So, you know, I've been fortunate to have some really good people in my life to help me get where I'm at. And so I would be remiss if I did not go back and help people, make myself available to anyone who wants to learn.
Yeah. Well, hey, Chief Waits, I have a question. So through your, you know, as you get out and travel across, you know, South Carolina and outside of South Carolina, do you see as far as agencies being receptive to having individuals come in and talk to their officers about mentoring and mentorship and leadership? What's your thoughts on that? Are agencies kind of reluctant to bring that in, or you had some? What's been your success with that?
I've been successful with it. You know, I don't see where anybody's putting any roadblocks anyway. You know, I got something coming up. I think at the end of the month is a retreat for law enforcement organization in the northern part of the state. They were doing a retreat, and they're bringing me in just for an hour to just to talk about leadership for their command staff members. And but it's a retreat away. They're going to be staying at this location, and you know, and they're bringing me in to do it. I don't see. I just hadn't experienced any roadblocks with that. I've had a good experience, and you know, from my perspective, you know, it's almost like, you know, I don't know if you gentlemen have children or not, but you can tell your kids something over and over and over sometimes, and they hear it, and they can even mimic it and say it before it comes out of your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it seems like when they hear it from another source, you see what I'm saying? All of a sudden, it clicks. You know what I'm saying? And it's validated. So from my perspective, I've never had a problem with bringing other folks in to do, you know, mentorship or do leadership training. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's really important that it's something that agencies really get behind and support and encourage, you know, to have that type of leadership training brought within the agencies, because oftentimes it's always good to hear another voice when you're talking about leadership. And Chief, you know, one of the things you mentioned earlier about, you know, the climate that we've been in, when you talk about everything that's happened with George Floyd to Breonna Taylor, if we could just go on with all the names that people have been affected by law enforcement. When you are talking with officers, does any of that come up as far as how they are seeing what's going on with law enforcement and what the future of law enforcement look like?
Yeah, it does come up, and it should. It should, and it shouldn't be a case, Chief Green. I don't believe that it should come up, you know, from the officer. It should be grumblings, you know what I'm saying, on the lower levels. I think people want to know when things happen. People want to know where their leaders stand, right? And I think we have to have a clear message and a clear voice when crisis comes. Might not be in your community, but it can be tomorrow, you know what I'm saying, or the next day. So if it happens around the country, I think it's important for us to bring that to the table right here wherever we are and have those conversations. You know, I'll never forget an experience, and I will call this. I've got to do some really fun things during my law enforcement career. I've got to do some really fun things, cool things. You know, I graduated from FBI National Academy. You know, I've had a great time. But if someone asked me, you know, hey, been the highlight of your career, I will go back to the aftermath of the George Floyd murder in my city. You know, there was civil unrest to the north of us. There was civil unrest to the south of us. And we actually got phone calls at the police department saying, hey, we're upset. You know, we want to protest. We want to march. But we want you to be a part of what we're doing. You know what I'm saying? Can we do this? Can we do this? Mm-hmm. Do you think we should? You know, they made us a part of the process. And for me, that was the biggest compliment. And because you gentlemen know that it doesn't have to happen that way. It does not have to happen that way. So we got that call, and we worked with the community, and we went out. We were there. We supported them, and it was a peaceful protest. Nothing bad happened that day. For me, that was a big time accomplishment. And so the conversation leading up to that event was with the department. And it was, you know, because some officers didn't know, well, why they got to be out here? Why they got to be doing this? And I'm like, look, what happened in everybody in this country's living room. We all saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
People are traumatized, and everybody doesn't know how to dispose of that. And so here we are. You know, I said, hey, you may go out here today and you may hear something you don't like. Somebody may call you outside your name. Somebody may do this. Somebody, you know, something bad happened and people are reacting, and you got to understand that. I said, but the most important thing is to realize that each and every one of you have this moment to walk out and shine a positive light on our industry. And that's what you need to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Yeah. Well, and you know, and I think this past year, you know, with the incident with George Floyd, is definitely, you know, everybody really had to step up and be a leader, especially when you have some officers who feel like what Chauvin did was justified, and you've got some who don't. But, you know, and then you've got some officers who had the attitude of when there's a Black Lives Matter protest, why should the police chief, why should we be out there? And I think that's, you know, when you are a good leader and you are able to sit down and talk with officers and to explain to them, this is why we're doing what we're doing, and we're going to do it as a group. Now people are able to see the frustration that other people are feeling. And I think that's why it's so important for officers to also remember, when you take off that uniform, you're just a civilian as well. So you've got to also have that have some compassion for what's going on, whether it's in your community or somebody else's community. But, hey, guys, we're coming up on the last few minutes of the show. You know, Chief Waits, I want you to give out your information, how people can get in touch with you, and information about your book.
Okay. The name of my book is Never Have a Bad Day. You can find it. You can go to my website, which is www.weightslifted.com, weightslifted.com. You can find the book there. Or you can find it at www.neverhaveabadday.net. That's www.neverhaveabadday.net. You can reach me through my email address. That's contact@kelvinwaits.com. And anytime if you just got a question or you're interested, you're inquiring about training or one-on-one coaching, feel free to give me a call, and I normally respond to everybody within 24 hours, but normally more quicker than that.
Well, good. Chief Humphrey. You know, Chief Waits, he gets quiet. You know, I think as the day go along, man, you know, that old folks syndrome starts setting in, man. You know.
No, I'm thinking about what insult I'm gonna throw at you. That's what I'm thinking about. I want to make sure I get the right insult. Hey, Chief Waits. Hey, brother. We're so honored. We're so honored that you joined us, man. And I'm proud of you, brother. And keep up the good work. And you could get a phone call from me any day, inviting you to come in. So I appreciate you, man. I'm proud of you.
I appreciate that. Well, I thank y'all for having me on the show with me. Awesome platform.
Yeah.
Awesome platform.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, Chief Waits, you know, this won't be the last time we'll be talking, and you have an open invitation to come on to the podcast show and talk to us about whatever it is you want to talk about. But, guys, it's been a great show, and Chief Waits, we want to, again, thank you for taking the time to come on You and the Law podcast show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. And, guys, we will get together next week, but stay tuned for another episode of You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
be cold.